This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in LA on 90.7 KPFK. We're talking about what Trump is actually doing, not just what he's tweeting. Later in this hour of Trump Watch, at the Trump White House, Steve Bannon, the fascist maniac, is out, and the calm bankers from Goldman Sachs are in. We'll speak with David Dan about what that means for tax reform and for our future. But first, Tom Frank. He's been on the road in Trumpland, touring red states, to talk about the new paperback edition of his book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Tom is the author of several books, including the classic What's the Matter with Kansas? He's been a columnist for the Wall Street Journal and Harper's, and a contributor to the New York Times and The Nation. Tom, welcome back.
John, great to be here.
Well, you wrote Listen Liberal before the 2016 election. In it, you argued that the Democrats had detached themselves from their historic constituency, ordinary working-class Americans. Your recent tour took you through the red states. You went to Pittsburgh, you went to Cleveland, you went to Columbus, you went to Indianapolis.
If you want to talk about lessons that I learned from touring Trump land, you know what the biggest one is?
What's the biggest lesson?
People really hated Hillary Clinton to a degree that even I, with my cynicism, my jadedness, that I did not understand. You know, I did not hate Hillary Clinton. I voted for her, and I agreed with Obama that she was the most qualified. You know, she's very qualified. She deserved to be president. All of these things. I thought she would have. I didn't think she'd be a great president, but I thought she'd be okay. Certainly better than Donald Trump. But what I discovered is I drove her but I knew how to hate Donald Trump. That's easy.
Yeah.
I mean, like, he boasts about groping women. He, you know, says these evil things about Mexicans and mocks the handicapped. I mean, it's unbelievable the stuff this guy did and said. So hating him was easy. What I did not understand was the degree to which people really hated Hillary Clinton. And that's ultimately what this election was. It's like, which one do you hate more?
And why? Weirdly, why? You've been to Pittsburgh.
That's the question. That's the question. What is it about her? I mean, because she's not offensive. She doesn't say rude things. She tries so hard to not offend people. I mean, she did make that remark about the deplorables. I think it is it's the very things that you and I like about Hillary are, you know, that she is so professional and she is so polished and she's such a wonderful lawyer. And she was, you know, went to Yale Law School and was so brilliant and was the best in her class and all these things. People hate this. They hate it. They hate what she represents, this kind of scolding liberalism that's always, you know, it's better than you. You know, Hillary is so saintly. This is one of the, I mean, remember what the chapter about Hillary in Listen Liberal,
yeah,
where I talked about her goodness and her righteousness, and I kind of made fun of her for it. What I didn't really understand is that, to me, that's sort of mockable, you know, like the stuff that she does with the Clinton Foundation and, you know, all the sort of righteousness signaling that Democrats like to do, that people like her like to do. People hate that stuff. Hate it. Just to double down on this a little bit, John, people running the Democratic campaign had no idea. They had no idea. And the Democrats, the Republicans kept Trump at arm's length all through the campaign. They knew that this guy was toxic. Okay. The Democrats did not do that with Hillary Clinton. They loved her without reservation. And not just them, the media, the press, the newspaper columnists. They could not imagine someone better than Hillary Clinton being, you know, a nominee for president. There's a real sort of Shakespearean tragedy to all this.
Summarize for us your case against the party of Hillary Clinton.
Well, it's that liberalism has basically, it's not what you think it is. It's not a philosophy of working class people anymore. It's not a party that really cares too much about the condition or the state of the middle class. It's a party that is attached to a different group. That's the sort of affluent white collar professionals who share a certain class perspective on the world. It's a story of social class, just not the social class everyone thinks of when they think of the Democratic Party. It's a pretty affluent, well-to-do group that they care very deeply about, and they share their worldview. And by the way, I voted for Hillary Clinton Hillary Clinton was the perfect embodiment of what I am talking about that's wrong with the Democratic Party.
So in your new afterword to the paperback of Listen Liberal, you remind us that the Democrats did have a choice in the primaries. On the one hand, there was the most qualified person ever to run for office who would make history by becoming the first woman president. On the other, there was a 74-year-old Jewish socialist from Vermont. You called him.
And he's the electable one.
You called him a living symbol of what the Democrats used to stand for. So why didn't Bernie win?
I think that Hillary beat him. I'm not one of these people that thinks that that she won the nomination by cheating. Her side did cheat. There's no doubt about that. The Democratic National Committee did cheat, but she also won fair and square. And why did Bernie lose the Democratic primaries? You know, first of all, he was a totally unknown quantity when those primaries started. Today, he's very well known. Today, people know all about him, and they sort of wish he was president, you know. But at the time, nobody knew who he was. He was an unknown quantity, and I think most damaging of all, he wasn't a Democrat. This is a man that never, you know, all those years in Congress, never signed up with the Democratic Party. He voted with them most of the time, and he caucused with them, but he never really joined the party. And so party insiders, people who vote in Democratic primaries, Democratic elected officials, there's no way they're going to support a guy like that. And here's Hillary, who has been promising these people things for decades now. She is their a sort of ideal candidate, you know.
Didn't the fact that the Democrats had adopted most of Bernie's issues at their convention have any impact on these places?
No, zero. They didn't even know that. Now, Bernie, by the way, Bernie Sanders is another thing I learned, remarkably popular politician, remarkably popular. This is a man that has very few scandals. I mean, I don't think he has any. I can't think of any. I think a lot of people regard him as a reassuring figure, as a comforting figure, because he reminds them of Democrats of old.
Yeah.
You know, he talks like a sort of Harry Truman kind of Democrat. And there's something very. I was in a union hall in Indianapolis. By the way, this is the union, the local that represents those workers at the carrier plant. You know, Trump made such a big deal out of this in the election. I spoke in their union hall, by the way, one of my better nights. It was a lot of fun. These are people where the rank and file, by and large, went for Trump. You know, a lot of them went for an unprecedented percentage of them went for Donald Trump because he was talking about not just their issues but their lives on the campaign trail. And all over this union hall are pictures of Bernie Sanders. They love this man. They love this man. And it's like you see that and suddenly, you know, you figure something out. Like when people say, well, would Bernie have been able to beat Donald Trump? The answer is hell yes, because these are the voters that defected, that left the Democratic Party and voted for Trump. They love Sanders. You know? Yeah, he would have beat Trump. Yes, hell yes.
So I've gone back into the dusty archives of the New York Times Magazine, and back in May of 2016, I found a headline, Thomas Frank thinks Hillary should woo the working class. And then I
Yeah, I did say that.
Then I went into the dusty archives of the Washington Post and found the headline, Nominating Sanders Would Be Insane. I wonder if you have any comment on this.
Yeah. Hey, John, at some point, I mean, it's like at some point every cliche is true. These people live in a bubble and they are totally disconnected from the life of this nation. And they just don't have any idea. I mean, the Washington Post, you know, they just don't have any, they don't have the faintest idea. Now, look, I understand why they'd say that. It's exactly what you said at the start. Bernie Sanders, you know, a Jewish socialist from Vermont, with, and let's never forget, with that crazy accent he has. To tell the Washington Post that that man is more electable than Hillary Clinton, they look at you like you're crazy. You know?
That accent, let me just say, that accent is a Brooklyn accent. That is a noble accent.
The first time I heard him, I thought, is that what a Vermont accent sounds like? Because no. I didn't know, right?
Well, now it's time for your Minnesota moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul. You were in the Twin Cities last week. Minnesota, of course, unlike Wisconsin and Michigan, is a blue state. It voted for Hillary. It has a Democratic governor. It has two Democratic senators, Amy Klobuchar and Al Franken. Minneapolis is represented in Congress by Keith Ellison, an African-American, the first Muslim elected to Congress.
Minneapolis, a great man, by the way.
Minneapolis is
These are all people that I admire, every single one of them.
And Minneapolis, I always like to point out, Minneapolis is represented in the state legislature now by Ilhan Omar, the first Somali refugee to be elected to statewide office in the United States. Hillary got about 70% of the vote in Minneapolis and St. Paul. How did things go for you in Minnesota?
Well, look, I'm selling a book, John. Things went really well. Minneapolis is one of these places that the Twin Cities, they read books there.
Yeah.
I mean, they read a lot of books there. And there's a lot of liberals there. There's a lot of people on the left there. So it's an ideal city for me, and I always do well there. The problem with what I do for a living with trying to get ideas across via books is that's not really who I was trying to reach this time around.
Yeah.
I'm trying to reach people up in like the Iron Range. The real story in Minnesota is not people in the Twin Cities who remain very Democratic. It's the miners and the farmers and the people in small towns. The party there, by the way, is called the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, and the farmers and the laborers, those are the people you got to worry about, and they are defecting. They are going to Trump, even in Minnesota.
Well, the media have been trying to explain what motivates Trump's followers, and of course, we've learned that they were ignorant racists who hated immigrants. But you say in the new paperback edition of Listen Liberal, you say Trump spoke about some entirely legitimate issues, especially what you call the one big grievance in capital letters. What was the one big grievance?
It's the slow disintegration of the middle class. You and I are on the left, John. We talk about this all the time, and we think it's our issue. I mean, Obama talked about it all the time, and we think we own this issue. And here's Trump. Trump did a much better job speaking to people's anger over this than Hillary did. Much, much, much better. Because he has this very colorful style. So by the way, I don't want to downplay Trump's bigotry. Trump is a bigot. I always state this very openly and frankly, right at the beginning of any talk I give about this guy. The things he said on the campaign trail are utterly unacceptable. And he should, in any other year, a guy who said things like that would be disqualified, would lose automatically. That said, Trump did talk about the issue of the disintegrating middle class, and the way that he talked about it was by talking about trade, people's grievance about NAFTA, and about the other trade agreements. And this really worked against Hillary Clinton because, of course, her name is Clinton. She's married to the man that gave us NAFTA.
Yeah,
she's the Secretary of State that helped to negotiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership. By the way, I wrote about this in March of 2016, a big article in The Guardian, probably one of the articles that has had the most readers of anything I've ever written. The Democrats completely blew it off, didn't pay any attention. You know, I said in that article, look at what Trump is talking about. Don't just say, oh, he's a bigot and a racist, and therefore all his followers are bigots and racists. Listen to what he's saying. He's actually talking about something real here. You better do something about it. And there's that comment of mine to the New York Times, Hillary better, figure out some way to reach out to working class voters. They didn't pay any attention. They didn't listen. The liberals didn't listen, John.
Tom Frank, his book, Listen Liberal, is out now in paperback with a new afterword. Tom, it's always great to have you on the show.
Yep, it is fun, John. That's right.
We recorded that interview for The Nation podcast. Next up, John Nichols on Bill O'Reilly, that's in a minute, on Trump Watch when our program continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in LA on 90.7 KPFK. Later in this hour at the Trump White House, Steve Bannon is out and the calm bankers from Goldman Sachs are in. David Dayan will talk about what that means for tax reform and for our future. But first, John Nichols. Of course, he's national affairs correspondent for The Nation. His most recent book is People Get Ready. Hi, John.
Hey, John. It's good to be with you. But I just want to, for your next segment,
yeah,
David, and he's so smart. But I will counsel, don't count Bannon out entirely.
Okay. I'll tell him. We'll.
I was just down, you know, Trump was just in Kenosha.
Yeah.
Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Signing executive orders. And I noticed Mr. Bannon standing right behind him there.
You were there in Kenosha.
Yeah. Mm.
Well,
just to give you a little counsel on that.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to talk about the news yesterday that Fox News fired the horrible Bill O'Reilly. Of course, he was the biggest star at the biggest cable news channel for more than a decade. He did a huge amount to poison our political culture and to make Trump president, and now he's gone. President Trump supported Bill O'Reilly. You remember he said, quote, he is a good person, close quote, and added, I don't think Bill did anything wrong. And O'Reilly shook hands with the Pope yesterday, but even the president and the Pope couldn't save Bill O'Reilly. How did this happen? That is our question for you. Who gets the credit?
I think some very courageous women get the credit.
Yeah.
They stepped up, clearly, coming out of a culture that didn't show them much respect, and also on a variety of fronts made their lives more difficult if they raised questions, if they challenged what was going on, at least by all evidence. And yet they pursued it, and their willingness to step up, and also the willingness of women to step up in solidarity with one another.
Yeah.
To say, as one woman came forward to say, you know, I hadn't spoken before, but I feel I need to speak now. I need to, you know, step up. The fact that many of these women did it and made a point of saying they're not suing, they're not going for money, they're doing it because something really is wrong. And I think that had a power.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting dynamic. I mean, let's not give Fox any pats on the back, okay? Remember that there were reports about this guy going back to 2004.
Wow.
At least. And discussions about him that going back certainly a long time. And concerns. And Fox clearly did not respect that. They also have, you know, a broader culture with, you know, obviously Roger Ailes, you know, having the problems that he had, having to leave. So this is a network that has serious, or had, and I would think still has, some serious challenges.
So here's a second way of looking at this. You've emphasized this happened, Bill O'Reilly fired because of the power of women. I think it's also, is it not an example of the power of the press? This was the New York Times reported back on April 1st that Fox News and O'Reilly had settled 5 sexual harassment suits for $13 million. Of course, we didn't know about these because part of the thing that happens when you get a settlement is that you sign a non-disclosure agreement, but they were able to find out the news. So I guess we need a free press. I guess we need investigative journalism.
Well, and it's an important part of this. I agree with you totally. Well, I think at the end of the day, I still put my stock in this regard with the women who stepped up, and the women who did challenge and object, because that's a really hard thing to do, and especially in a lot of these power situations. But yes, the Times then took that story and took it places in a very responsible and very serious way, and then it kept on it.
Yeah.
That I think was very effective. And you say the power of the press, we need a free press. You're absolutely right. But we also need something else, which is a press that does something that's kind of hard to do, and that is to treat the free press, you know, as a news story into itself. And that means the media has to cover media.
Yeah.
And sometimes, historically, there's been a caution about that. At times it's been, you don't want to acknowledge the importance of other media. Sometimes major media outlets don't want to acknowledge that other major media outlets are influential and that they themselves are influential, that the political process doesn't just happen in a vacuum, that how media approaches things, its role in this process is newsworthy. And so the Times did something that was important, beyond just valuable and influential in this regard. It was important. It took a story about a major media outlet and aggressively pursued it.
Yeah.
And we need a lot more of that. In general, because we can't lie to ourselves and tell ourselves that, you know, media, especially in this age, doesn't influence and in many ways even define our politics.
Yeah. So there's one other factor I want to bring up here. It's it's interesting that that Fox did not fire Bill O'Reilly because of falling ratings. In fact, his ratings went up during this period. The very loyal mm-hmm. fans of Bill O'Reilly actually like the fact that, in their view, he's standing up to the New York Times reporting on sexual harassment. It wasn't the ratings that seemed to have been the breaking point for Fox. It seems like it was the advertisers pulling out. So many, you know, a couple of dozen major advertisers pulled out of O'Reilly's show, and that's what seems to have made the difference to Fox. How come so many of O'Reilly's advertisers pulled out?
Well, I think, again, this is, you know, that we live in an age where there is a growing understanding that when you are associated with something, when your product, if you will, is associated with something that is unsettling, troubling, wrong-headed, wrong, whatever word we want to use, that's bad for you. And I think that consumers are getting dramatically more sophisticated. You know, we always talk about the power of boycotts and whether boycotts work.
Yeah.
And they don't always. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But I think consumers are becoming much more sophisticated. And I think this is a function of the moment we are in, that Donald Trump is such a conflicted and commercial entity into himself, even as president of the United States, members of his family as well. And so people are really starting to wake up to that, I think, and to recognize that they don't want to support necessarily products that, you know, that help to encourage things they really disagree with morally, ideologically, politically. And so I do think that in this incredibly divided, intense moment politically that we're in, companies were more cautious, more concerned about this than perhaps at other times in the past. Also, I think that corporate America, for all of its flaws, and I'm a huge critic of corporate America.
Yes.
But I do think that it's evolving, mm-hmm. right? And that there is a genuine recognition on the part of many corporations because of pressure brought on them by women's groups and by activists that, you know, they have to think about these things.
Yeah.
So a lot of stuff came together. I will counsel you, though, too. There's another subtlety of cable networks that, and obviously Bob and Chesney have written a lot about this. Cable networks build their nighttime, which is where they make their big money, mm-hmm. around one star, usually, right? And that star draws a lot of people in, and people tune in before a show and maybe stick with the network afterwards, right? So you've got kind of your flag that you fly highest. And O'Reilly was that for Fox. And that's one of the reasons why so many advertisers had to leave before Fox actually decided to drop the guy. You know, that they desperately wanted to keep him there because he really was. Those ratings that he got, you know, had meaning beyond his own show.
Yeah.
It was his presence there that helped to feed into the other shows. So losing him is a big, big deal for Fox. Now, the question that we have in the next weeks and months is just how big a deal? And that's what we're going to find out. It's going to be fascinating because you may genuinely see some decline in overall viewership for Fox. And that's one of the reasons why I think, despite the fact that obviously internally they knew they had problems quite a long time ago, they just stuck with this guy for a very long time.
So I want to shift now to our other big topic, the recent elections that we have seen, starting with the House race in suburban Atlanta, where Democrat John Ossoff almost won. He got 48.1%. Will go to a runoff. This is a Republican district. This is Newt Gingrich's old seat. It's been Republican for decades. Now the Democrats think they might be able to flip it. The runoff will be in June. Tell us about this Georgia House race and what happened.
Well, it's Tom Price's seat. Tom Price has gone over to HHS, where he's trying to mangle our health care system. And actually doing a pretty good job of mangling things, by the way. And his exit there opened up a seat in a district that, because of Price's long-term presence and because of his immense ability to raise money, he was a huge fundraiser, they had kind of scared off Democratic opponents in the past, or at least not attracted the strongest Democratic opponents. Once Price was gone, and in the unique circumstance of a special election, which is you have a wide-open initial primary where candidates of all parties can run, Democrats saw an opening, and this young guy, John Ossoff, stepped up and made the run. I think early on, even at that point, because of the shell shock coming off the 2016 election, Democrats weren't really fully aware of their possibilities there. But Ossoff ran hard, and high credit to some of our activist groups like Daily Coast, DFA, and others that recognized early on that there was a possibility there. Mm-hmm. And that allowed Ossoff to raise money to kind of really step out and be the clear Democratic alternative to all the Republicans. And he just did really well. And I have to tell you, John, I was skeptical about that race. I thought that I had a sense that people might be over-talking it early on. And when the results came in, that influenced my assessment, just for me, and I'm expressing my weaknesses here, it influenced my assessment of that race because he did better. If he'd gotten 42 or 43%, then the front-running candidate, but not really close to 50, I would have said to you, yeah, those Republicans are going to unite and pull this thing together. But the fact of the matter is, he got a really strong vote. Runoffs often don't have as high a vote turnout as the initial election, and yet his base seems to be incredibly energized. And so I think it is reasonable to say that he could win this race.
Now, I have to raise the objection. I have to raise the objection that our colleague at The Nation, Don Guttenplan, published yesterday, I think. He called the Ossoff campaign an expensive sideshow and complained Ossoff is running as a pragmatic centrist, not a political revolutionary. He said the result that has so impressed you and me, I should say, tells us, quote, little about the prospects for bolder candidates with more audacious agendas. A winning smile and the ability to avoid controversy will never be enough to turn this country around. Don Guttenplan at thenation.com. What do you think about Don's argument?
Well, I love the way he wrote that. And I don't have any problem with, I have no problem was saying that a winning smile is not enough to save America, right? I think that's a, I'm going to give you that argument.
Okay.
In fact, and respect it. But here's the twist I will give you. And that is that if you've covered a lot of politics in the South and in some of these districts that have really gone, hardcore Republican over recent years, one of the things you understand is that in the parlance of a lot of these southern districts, if you're a Democrat, as far as a lot of the media in these regions and a lot of the political dialogue in these regions, you're as left-wing as can be, right? They presume you're off the deep end, right? And you're a Democrat in Alabama, you're a courageous person, right? Or in some parts of Georgia. And so What I would suggest is a twofold thing here that's important to put into our analysis. I'm a passionate believer the Democratic Party has to change, that it needs to become dramatically more progressive, especially on economic issues, but also on a host of social issues. However, I also think that there are regional differences, to be sure, and even within states, there are areas, suburban areas that may be different,
right,
and some rural populist areas and some cities. So that's one distinction to make, just as how we frame out our politics.
And let me just underline here that this district is the kind of classic Republican suburban white district where you need a good smile and to be young and good looking if you're going to get anywhere.
Maybe, you know, I mean, which rules us out, John.
It certainly does.
But let me throw one other element in the mix here too. When you are in difficult moments, when you are in moments that are highly combative, highly complex politically, it matters what happens in special elections.
Yeah.
Okay? And I am I'm a passionate believer that individual special elections in a complex and challenging moment tell us a lot. And if we go back, I am old enough to remember when Richard Nixon was in trouble, starting to get in trouble politically in 1973, 1974, and one of the biggest signals of how bad his trouble was, and one of the things that actually gave Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee courage to vote for articles of impeachment, was a series of special election results. And Democrats were winning where they had not won in years. And the interesting thing about that is that many of those Democrats who won were not, you know, the most progressive or the most perfect contenders, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were winning sometimes surprise races. Sometimes there were people who you didn't even think were going to have a chance, and they won. And so I think we should not underestimate the power of an unexpected victory in a place like suburban Atlanta, in a place like Kansas, in a place like Montana, where we'll have an election quite soon.
Let's shift to Montana now. There's a Senate race in Montana, an open Senate seat in Montana. The Democrats are running a man named Rob Quist, who I didn't know anything about.
I'm going to correct you, John, who I love.
Yes.
It's a House race.
House race, pardon me. House race. The New York Times ran a photo of this guy, Rob Quist, today. He wears a cowboy hat and black jeans and plays the guitar. Montana has always, for recent years, had Democratic governors, I think four elections mm-hmm. in a row. Mm-hmm. It now has one Democratic senator. So they think they have a chance to flip this House seat in Montana. What's your assessment?
So I love this Montana race. This one excites me, frankly, a lot more. I mean, I really like the Kansas race. I thought the Kansas race was undercovered, and the Democrats really blew a chance there. They got to 45%. I think they could have done much better if they put a little bit of resources and effort in from outside. The Montana race, similarly. Here's the bottom line. This guy who's running is very much of Montana.
Yeah.
He gets how to campaign there. He gets the state. He knows every corner of it. He's a guy who lives there and has lived there his whole life. I don't know about his whole life, but certainly as much of it that would matter. And he's a solid contender who also brings in sort of this outsider, relatively independent sensibility. He is sort of a Bernie Sanders kind of guy as opposed to a centrist Democrat. And I think in a state like Montana, that actually has potential to resonate. If you look at their sitting U.S. Senator, John Tester, he's a very populist guy who, you know, he hunts and fishes and you know, in many ways, you know, really fits the Montana image. And yet when he votes on economic issues and a host of them, he's really quite good. And so I think Chris has some real possibilities. And also, John, I'm going to suggest to your readers or listeners, if any of them ever liked the band Pure Prairie League or Poco
okay.
or any country rock band, you know, this guy was in the top country rock band in Montana for years.
Wow.
Like, everybody who ever went to a concert, like, you know, outdoor concert on a beautiful summer night in some Montana, at some Montana County Fairgrounds, has heard this guy play.
Fantastic.
I know.
And I should also want to say the Republican who's running against him is a New Jersey native who's a software billionaire. That seems like a great matchup to me.
I love, you know, so you got the country rocker, right?
Yeah.
Who's just like been in the band, driving across the state, you know, singing and playing for you, who actually is also super smart, knows the issues, cares passionately, happens to be a real strong supporter of worker rights and farmers and ranchers. Against the guy from New Jersey.
The
only counsel I give is that Democratic Party has clearly a hard time with these sort of, you know, candidates who are more hardwired to their place than they are to some sort of national set of talking points.
Yeah.
And so one of the things the Democratic Party needs to do desperately, and this goes back to Don's point, which is a good one, the Democratic Party needs to recognize that it's outsider candidates, it's candidates who challenge economic and political orthodoxy, may well be the winners they're looking for. And so I'm hoping that they get the dynamic of Montana, that they don't tell this guy in Montana how to run his campaign, but do give him the support and encouragement that he needs. They didn't do that in Kansas. I think they blew that race. This is one they could win.
And when is the Montana election?
Oh, it's a little ways off, a few weeks yet. And it, you know, we're going to, here's what's going to happen, John. We've had the Kansas race. They blew it. We had the Georgia race. They got a chance. Now we're going to have this Montana race. Then we're going to come back and have Georgia runoff. And then, before the year is done, John, I got news for you. The governor of Alabama threw a wrench into things and has decided to call a special election for the Alabama U.S. Senate seat.
Yeah.
And you say, well, oh my gosh, well, Democrats could never win a Senate seat in Alabama. I'll tell you, you look at the scandals and the controversies down there, I think that's going to be a real race. What we got is a pretty fun year, John.
It's a pretty fun year, and you and I are going to come back to this many times in the coming months. John Nichols, read him at thenation.com. John's always great to have you on the show.
A total pleasure, my friend. Take care.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK with Trump Watch and TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Next up, the Goldman Sachs takeover at the Trump White House. That's in a minute on KPFK when Trump Watch continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK, streaming at kpfk.org and online anytime you want it at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Coming up at 5 on KPFK, This Is Happening, Jerry Quickly with James Forman Jr., a professor of law at Yale Law School, who writes for the New York Times, lots of other big places, and a former clerk for Sandra Day O'Connor. He'll be talking about the legal issues that face us these days. But first, news from the Trump White House. Maybe you heard that Steve Bannon, the fascist maniac, has stepped back as a key advisor and has been replaced by the guys from Goldman Sachs, the calm and rational engineers of globalization. For comment, we turn to David Dayan. He's the author of the award-winning book Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Greatest Foreclosure Fraud. He writes for The Intercept, The American Prospect, The Atlantic, and The Nation. David Dayan, welcome back.
Oh, thanks, John.
Well, I guess we should be relieved that Steve Bannon is no longer in the lead of Trump advisors. But can we really be sure that he's out of power? We just spoke with John Nichols, who said that when Trump was in Kenosha yesterday, Bannon was traveling with him. Remind us what the evidence is that Bannon has had to take a step back.
Well, there have been, you know, tons of published reports regarding the sort of White House infighting. But I think it came to a head last week when President Trump, in a series of interviews and press events, flip-flopped on, over half a dozen issues, moving from what would be seen as the sort of populist or Bannonist position over to a position that's more comfortable with what is sometimes derided as the globalist position. And this is on making China, designating them for their mercantilist trade policies. Trump ends up supporting the Export-Import Bank, which was something that right-wing populists had railed against. And on and on down the line. And all of these things sort of move towards the Gary Cohn. Gary Cohn is the head of the National Economic Council. It moved towards his point of view. This guy was the president of Goldman Sachs, actually.
Wow.
For over a decade. So it's pretty clear now, though Bannon might be sidelined, Bannonism, with respect to immigration policy, with respect to law enforcement, might certainly live on. But when we're talking about economic policy, and particularly anything involving globalization, trade, those kinds of things, it does seem like the pendulum has shifted toward the Gary Cohn style. And that's why in my Nation article I called it, him President Cohn.
So I guess we should be relieved that the fascist maniac Steve Bannon has had to step back. But how content can we be that the calm and rational globalizer, Gary Cohn of Goldman Sachs, is now sort of calling the shots for what is going to happen with the American and the world economy?
I don't think we should be relieved at all. I think Cohnism is deeply harmful to any American who doesn't fancy himself a corporate executive. Most of the flips are generally in the position of keeping corporate welfare flowing, making sure that the multinational corporations that outsource their production and labor to lower and lower paying countries continues unfettered. There really is not anything here that looks particularly good for the American worker. What we know about Gary Cohn is that he wants to roll back financial regulations, that he wants to facilitate more trading in financial markets and more gambling essentially in the Wall Street casino. And on and on down the line. And I don't think that there is any sigh of relief to be breathed by the preeminence of Gary Cohn.
Well, the Trump people say the next big thing on their agenda is tax reform. I guess we should put that in quotes. After the failure to repeal and replace Obamacare, next they're going to try to reform taxes. All Trump has said really on this topic is, quote, "I want to cut the hell out of taxes," close quote. Of course, Republicans always want lower taxes for rich people. But, of course, Goldman Sachs has a much more ambitious agenda than simply cutting the top tax rates. What do you think is the Goldman tax reform plan?
Well, I mean, I think what you see more is an emphasis on corporate tax rates and getting those down as much as possible in order to, allow corporations to not only keep more of what they end up earning, but to leak that out to executives and shareholders through dividends, through buybacks, through executive compensation. And I think that would be, you know, broadly in line with the Cohn way here.
Now, let me just ask you a question at this point. How many, what proportion of Trump voters do you think voted for him because they want to cut corporate taxes?
Yeah, almost none of them.
Almost none, yeah.
You know, in fact, all of these flips that we saw last week would not have been out of place if they came out of the mouth of Jeb Bush.
Oh.
You know, this is a Donald Trump presidency that has now pivoted to a Jeb Bush policy agenda. And that,
wow.
That's certainly not what any of Trump's most fervent supporters expected. When they you know, destroyed Jeb Bush in the primaries and put Trump in the White House.
So if they're going to cut corporate taxes and they still want to do something to try to keep the budget somewhat in balance, they need to find more money someplace. And Paul Ryan has argued for years that the way to do that is to tax imports. He says an import tax, making imports more expensive, will help restore jobs in domestic manufacturing. So that seems part of the Trump Republican ideology that we're going to bring back those good manufacturing jobs. But the main reason they want this import tax is they really need the money to balance the budget if they cut the corporate income taxes, which, as you said, is really their number one goal. They call this the border adjustment tax, the BAT. BAT.
Right.
They need the BAT to balance the budget. Donald Trump has never really said he supports an import tax. What do the Goldman people think about taxing imports?
Yeah, I think the BAT has turned around and smacked them right in the head. the border adjustment tax is not likely to happen at this point. Retailers, of course, hate it because they get most of their products through imports.
From China, as a matter of fact.
That's correct. And they have been very strong out of the gate in condemning this border adjustment tax. And it doesn't look like the administration is terribly into it. A very interesting interview last week with the budget director of the White House, Mick Mulvaney, where he essentially said that you know, the administration doesn't really care about deficits if they get in the way of tax cuts. You know, what we saw in the Bush administration is they did a massive tax cut package, and they did it through this process called reconciliation, where they could do it with just 50 votes. And what they did is they you know, to comply with those rules, they just let it sunset in 10 years. And they were allowed to blow a hole in the deficit as long as the tax cuts stopped in 10 years. And I think ultimately that's where you're going to get with this Trump tax cut, because all of the pay-fors, you know, for example, this border adjustment tax, just aren't going to fly with large portions of the Republican allies, including retailers and heavy industry. Even the Koch brothers are against the border adjustment tax. So instead of trying to find this way to pay for these, the other option is to just not pay for them and have them sunset after 10 years and then hope that down the line you can you know, re-up them and make them permanent. That is certainly what happened in the Bush years, and I think we're headed for a rerun.
But isn't there a significant group of the Republicans, especially in the House, who are budget hawks, who are saying that they don't want to blow a hole in the budget of the kind that we're talking about
right,
here?
Right, of course, but you don't realize that tax cuts are magical, and they actually don't cause any deficits, and they pay for themselves.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
This is the claim.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, said this today, that tax cuts create such a boost to the economy that they end up paying for themselves. Now, this doesn't bear out in any view of history, but that's what they're going with. And so they'll be able to sort of pull the wool over the eyes of the public by claiming that these won't create massive deficits, when in fact the opposite is the case.
If you've just tuned in, we're speaking with David Dayen. He's written for The Nation about the shift from, quote President Bannon, to who he calls President Gary Cohen, the rise of the Goldman Sachs people in the Trump White House. You know, I thought the Goldman Sachs people were Democrats because they staffed the Obama White House and they certainly were part of the Clinton campaign. What have I got wrong here?
I think Goldman Sachs is more part of the Green Party, but green would be the color of money. I don't think that their ideological alliances matter very much as long as they can get in and take functional control of the economy. And so, you know, with Cohn, what we know is that he was a registered Democrat right up until 2009 when... Yeah. And 2010, when the Dodd-Frank Act passed, which increased regulation on financial institutions, and right at that moment, Cohn shifted all of his donations from Democrats to Republicans. So you can see that he cares more about his interests than any sort of residual ideological profile.
Yeah.
And he's more interested in making sure that the world is safe for Goldman Sachs to make lots and lots of money.
I have one other question about taxing imports. I agree with you that Donald Trump is not the kind of, although he likes the argument that we can restore, we can, quote, bring back the good manufacturing jobs. He is kind of a retailer himself. I mean, he retails, you know, ties and Trump hats, and the whole hotel world is kind of a retail world. So he's very sympathetic to Walmart and Target and Best Buy and the places that have been lobbying him against the border adjustment tax. But what do we think? What do you and I at The Nation magazine think about taxing imports?
The border adjustment tax, I'm not sure, is a great way to go. We don't really know what that would do for, you know, middle-class families in terms of the prices they would have to pay on goods.
They would go up.
It's a tax that really easily could be shifted onto the back of the consumer.
Yeah.
It's regressive in that sense. You know, it's not a progressive tax. It's something that would hit the prices that everyone would pay.
Yeah.
So, a guy named Marshall Steinbaum has a very good report at the Roosevelt Institute talking specifically about the border adjustment tax. So I urge your listeners to Google that and check it out. You know, the claim is that, this won't affect anything because the price of the dollar would adjust to compensate for these imports, and everything would stay in balance. But that's based on very sketchy foundations. It's very Econ 101 and not the real world.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to really say what the impacts would be, but they could be very grave. And another way that they could be very grave is for emerging markets. I mean, if the price of the dollar ends up rising because of this change in the way taxes are done at the border, then these countries that have a lot of debt in dollars suddenly wouldn't be able to pay it. So a weird residual effect of this kind of a shift in the taxation would be that a lot of these countries would end up defaulting, and we don't know what kind of what the banks have in terms of being exposed to this level of debt. And so there's a lot that's very sketchy about it. They're just trying to sort of shove it through without explaining what the consequences would be.
So it seems like the Republicans' top priority now is going to be to cut corporate taxes. There was a recent survey by the Pew Research Center, nonpartisan, which asked people what bothered them about the tax system. 62% said they are bothered a lot that corporations do not pay their fair share of taxes. That was the biggest single thing that bothered Americans. 60% said they are bothered that wealthy people do not pay their fair share. How many are bothered by the tax rate that they themselves pay? Only 27% of Americans said they're bothered a lot by the amount they pay in taxes. The Republican argument, of course, is that poor people don't pay any taxes, and this is an outrage, and we got to do something about it. Only 20% were bothered a lot by that idea that poor people don't pay enough. So it seems like if the Trump White House is going to be at all sensitive to public opinion, they are going to have a hard job selling a corporate tax cut to the American people.
Yeah, somehow I don't think that these concerns are going to be reflected in what Washington is going to try to do. But you make a good point in terms of popularity. I mean, we're already seeing the Trump administration kind of flailing down at somewhat historic lows for an incoming president. And this pivot to a Jeb Bush style of stodgy old corporate republicanism, in my view, is only going to make the situation worse, because you're going to lose folks on the right who thought there was a new sheriff in town who wasn't going to go along with the same old corporate Republican ways, and the left is pretty entrenched in its opposition to Trump. So that combination seems pretty deadly. Not only is this shift to the Goldman Sachs view going to be, you know, pretty bad for the country in terms of the economy, but it seems like it's going to be pretty bad for President Trump's approval rating.
David Dayan says Donald Trump is turning into Jeb Bush on economic issues. He really knows how to hurt a guy. Read David Dayan at thenation.com. David, it's been great having you on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, John.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK, and this is Trump Watch. Hey, Trump Watchers, you can listen to Trump Watch anytime you want at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. One more thing before we go, John Coltrane. There's a documentary, Chasing Train, terrific movie. It'll be screening tomorrow, Friday, at the Landmark on Pico in West L.A., the 7:20 p.m. showing. Will be followed by a Q&A with the director, John Scheinfeld, and the drummer for The Doors, John Densmore, who's one of the people in the film. Chasing Train is a terrific documentary made by the guy who made The U.S. versus John Lennon, which I've heard is really good. Chasing Train is set against the social, political, and cultural landscape of the 60s. It includes talk about Coltrane with fans ranging from Cornel West to Sonny Rollins to Bill Clinton. You may recall that Bill Clinton is a tenor player himself, although he doesn't play like John Coltrane. So Chasing Train, the documentary, tomorrow at the Landmark on Pico, 7:20 p.m., followed by a Q&A. This special screening is presented by KPFK. So thank you, Maggie LePeak. Well, that's it for today's Trump Watch. I want to thank my other guest, John Nichols, talked about Bill O'Reilly and the upcoming elections in the House. David Dayan explained the Goldman Sachs takeover, and Tom Frank talked about his travels in the Rust Belt. Thanks to our engineer, D'Angelo. Thanks to our producer, Renee Reynolds. Thanks, as always, to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK, this is happening. Jerry Quickly. Trump Watch returns next week at the same time on this same station. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.